Session number 11944.
Judge Joanne, Rule 8. When you were actually making your run in to the beach, doing the circling and the movement in, could you actually recognise the terrain you were going to move
yes.
over?
Yes. We'd seen it. It was the on the aerial photographs, the sea level aerial photographs. Yes, you could see the church towers and that sort of thing. Yes, you could see those.
So you've got a very good idea of what you're going to be.
Yes, we were. Our landing was very accurate, as far as we could judge. We seemed to be going to the right place, and it was as we'd expected.
So I can get this right. You managed to get ashore despite your difficulties with the waders and the deep hole in the sea. Crossed the beach swiftly without any undue difficulty. Moved inland.
Yeah, this is everybody. Because what happened was that somebody threw a rope, because the boat was further out than people had anticipated.
Had it gone ashore on a sandbar then?
I'm not sure, but it wasn't right up as it had been on Smash 1 and Smash 2. It was further out. There was a depth of water which was deeper than a man. I suspect it was probably about 10 feet, 12 feet. And it couldn't get any further in. It was the sea was pushing the waves. And somebody threw a rope across, perhaps that sailor, American sailor, somebody threw a rope across, and I know I got the end of it. And in due course, the chaps came down, whether the boat had got a bit further in or on the wave, I don't know. But they all came along, and nobody else had any difficulties, I don't think. So that was all right.
And did you see any signs of the preliminary bombardment having taken effect?
Well, yes, there were big holes, and I think aerial bombardment. There seems to be bomb craters, that sort of thing. And, of course, the shelling in the houses. Lots of damage of that kind. But certainly nothing of the type you've mentioned with Hamel, or what it was called. It seemed to have been very effective.
How far inland did you move then on that first day?
On the first day, we moved quite a distance. We moved further, I think. I suppose we landed, 8 o'clock in the morning, was it? I think something like that, I'm not sure. But we moved for most of the day. We kept moving. And again, we saw the Brigadier around and various other people came round. And I suppose we must have got well on the way to Bayeux, but how far, I don't know. But we got a good way. And then we got the order to pull up and dig in for the night.
Do you remember where you were when you got that order?
No. No, but we were well off the beach, away from the expected night raids, as far as we were concerned. And
had you actually run into any substantial enemy opposition by
no.
that stage?
No. We'd seen the odd tank, but they'd not fired at us, and we hadn't fired at them. They were a distance away, and we watched them. They were stalking us, and we were stalking them, really. I think that was the position. We were going cannily and feeling our way as best we could. When we dug in that night, I was sent for to battalion headquarters, and I found that the second in command was commanding the battalion, because Colonel Lidwell, who was commander of our normal commanding officer, had gone to brigade, the brigadier having disappeared. And as I'd already indicated my remarks earlier, I was very fond of this brigadier. It's Brigadier Senior, I think. And I was sent for, and I was told that he had disappeared. Nobody knew where he was, and that it was necessary for us to search for him in the hope that he'd been taken prisoner and not removed from the area. I was told to take half a dozen men with bicycles, which I got from Ian English's company, and in the dusk, moving to darkness, I went round looking for the Brigadier. I was told he was probably being held in some wood or copse. And I remember that the password that day was bread and cheese. And my task was to go to copse after copse, wood after wood. And if I heard any movement, I was to whisper hoarsely, bread, and hope that I got the countersign, cheese, and that was all right. If they weren't there, then I was to, presume they were Germans. And I spent the whole of that first night, having had no sleep the night before, going round looking for the brigadier. I never found him. You'll probably know that he had been ambushed. He'd been taken prisoner. His signaller and his driver had been killed. He was saved because he had a red hat. His captors were a few Germans, half a dozen, I think, who were in under the command of a corporal, German corporal. They were all very apprehensive, and they wanted to get out. And they wanted to kill the brigadier, who could speak German, and therefore was able to report this. They wanted to kill him and get out. The corporal said no, not because he was a prisoner of war or anything like that, but because he was a man with a red hat, and therefore must be very high up in the English army, and therefore would have a lot of information to give to his superiors. So the corporal insisted on saving the brigadier's life. The brigadier waited, was tied up. He waited till nightfall, and then once things had quieted down a bit, he managed to roll into a ditch and wriggle down the ditch well out of the way. In due course, the Germans found out that he'd gone and immediately panicked and ran and left him, and he was escaped. But he was a very lucky man. But I never found him. And it was an interesting night to my D-Day.
Did you actually find any signs of enemy while you were doing this night patrol?
Well, no, because every place seemed to be occupied by the Pioneer Corps or the Ordnance Corps. They were all mixed up. Nobody knew where anything was. This really was one of the first occasions when the lack of communication was noticeable, although, of course, it was understandable with the actual landing. But nobody really knew what they were doing except going down the road and getting to the next place. Subsequently, I did get some sleep later because we didn't move immediately the next day. We went down to Bayeux. The people were going down to Bayeux, I think, and I don't think they got on D2. I'm not sure when they got it, but we didn't get it. Somebody else took it because at about that time we were sent off to Saint-Pierre. And it was at that stage that Tilly and the Bocage country really reared their ugly head for the first time, as far as we were concerned. I remember being briefed by Tommy Clapton, the company commander, for the attack on Saint-Pierre, and he was in high spirits, or appeared to be in high spirits, because he said we were going off on a little trip. He said there were some cadets, a few cadets with revolvers, hiding out in this village, wherever it was, just near it, and they got an odd tank or two, an armoured car or two, and that we had to go and wipe them out or deal with them. And we were told that, I think I'm correct in saying it, it was a brigade of tanks that we were to take with us, and we were to be their infantry. And even in those days I was a little sceptical approach, because I asked him why it was necessary to take a brigade of tanks and a battalion of infantry today with a few dozen little boys with pistols and the odd tank. And of course, as we learnt later, the little boys were the Hitler Youth and the tanks. I'm not sure it was Hitler Youth or the Panzerlehr. There was the Panzerlehr people were there, the tanks. I rather thought it was 10th SS, but I may be wrong. But there was certainly, our target was the joining point between two German divisions, one armoured and the other crack troops, and we were being sent off on that expedition. We went off there. I think if I remember correctly, we assembled on the St. Ledger feature, I think it was called, and we were given the job of actually riding on the tanks to save walking. And we all mounted the tanks we were going with, hung on the back wherever we could, and set off across these ploughed fields and stubbly fields towards wherever we were going. Ian English's men on their bicycles were having a terrible job because, of course, they couldn't climb onto the tanks with their bicycles. They couldn't ride the bicycles over the stubble. And I'm afraid that some of them were very lazy indeed, and they pushed the bicycles under the tank traps. So the bicycles were crushed, and then they climbed up the back of the tank with the rest of us. And I think the bicycles themselves were a complete waste of time.
What sort of tanks were they? Were these Churchills?
Churchills, I think it was Churchills. But I'm not sure, you see, because they weren't the infantry support people. They were the cavalry.
Possibly, they were Shermans.
They were Shermans, and what's more, I think they were petrol Shermans, in view of what happened later. Anyway, we went to a place called Point 103, and there we dismounted. The tanks stayed there in a Liga, and we set off down to the village.
That would have been, what, about a mile and a half?
About a mile and a half, something, down the gentle slope down, across open fields, completely open country, and into the village. And as far as I can remember, we had two companies on the front, on the Tilly side, and the river and the bridge, and two companies at the back. And I was one of the companies at the back, and I was on the left facing the enemy.
So you were on the eastern side of the...
It would be the eastern side, yes. And I remember now there was a long line of poplar trees, which is still there because I saw it myself a year or two ago when I went back. The line of poplar trees with a ditch underneath, and we fanned out into that area, overlooking open country. Ian English was, and Johnny Laybourne were in the two forward companies, and my company, Tommy Clapton's company, was on this position. I forget who was commanding the... Oh, Chris Beattie was commanding the other rear company. There we spent the night. We dug in. Nothing really happened at that stage. And we were reasonably pleased with the way in which we'd advanced considerable distance from the beach by then. I think it was the next morning that the counter-attack came. Heavy shelling and mortaring and so on, attack going on in the on the two forward companies. Again, complete confusion. We were being shelled by tank guns, which we could see across the open country.
Were they over to your east then?
Yes. And they were firing in at us, and they were firing their shells into the trees. As a result, we were being showered with shrapnel. And they were coming, and there was nothing between us and the enemy tanks. And we pulled out. Now, why I hesitate, and I'm not sure that this was the... first event, or if another incident happened with our tanks first, But be that as it may, we were attacked. The two Ford companies appear to be overrun. They suffered casualties, in the sense, I think, prisoners. There were quite a few dead. You mentioned, asked me earlier about a pit. It was at that juncture that Sergeant Wallbanks managed to hold up a tank which was coming around, edging its way down the main street in this village, and he I think, blew a track off with a pit. I think that was there. Johnny Wheatley, my old friend and company commander, was killed in the main street, just with blast. I saw him later, and there wasn't a mark on him, but something obviously killed him. A lot of people were injured there. The casualties were quite horrible. And, again, complete confusion. We pulled back until we were across the, in some way, across the back of the village. And by this time, we only had the open country behind us. Going back to point 103, the tanks were there waiting for us. We couldn't get out. We couldn't break cover because we'd been in a real killing area. And so we had to stand and fight. And again, it was complete confusion. I remember at that stage, Johnny Walker, who was the adjutant, took charge. And we had a weird collection of people from various companies, or various companies in various positions. We had various people like cooks, stretcher bearers, the doctor. We were all there, more or less shoulder to shoulder. And the regimental sergeant major was running around dropping boxes of ammunition between each little group, behind each little group. We had an odd tank mixed up with us somewhere. And we were told by Johnny Walker that we were to keep absolutely quiet until the Germans came, until the order was given. And that we did, waiting. And eventually, the infantry, German infantry, started coming. They were jumping over the back walls of the houses near which we were. They were jumping over, running round the gardens, coming down the road and so on, and moving quite quickly in a frontal attack. And I know we waited patiently until we got the order. And then when we did get the order to fire, everybody fired rapid. And it was a tremendous relief to be doing something. And that was that. The Germans never came any further. I think they'd been surprised that there were so many of us. They'd been surprised by the concentrated fire from everything, the tank, the mortars, everybody was firing. And we stopped it.
What sort of range did you let them get to before opening up?
I suppose about 50 yards. They were quite close. But, you know, jumping over the wall, pepper-potting over. And so they were very near. But they never brought the tanks in again. They never came up with a tank down the main street. That was finished. That's why we blocked the road with the knocked-out tank. Now, what confused me was that whilst I was telling you that, there was a tank in amongst us. I can't remember where that tank came from, because there was a terrible scene when the armour emerged from point 103 and did an attack across this open land to join us in the village. And as I'm saying, I'm not sure whether the tank attack came first or whether they attacked us first. Perhaps the tank attack came first. Anyway, the tanks came really like the US cavalry across this open land. It was a full-scale a formation tank attack, and they were absolutely butchered. The Germans had their 88 guns, and they were just knocking them off like Aunt Sally's. And the sky was full of this black smoke. They were all brewing up, as we called it, on the fire. And it was a very serious loss of armour as a result of this particular tank attack across the the open land. Germans had them absolutely beat them. And we had a lot of men who'd fortunately managed to escape from the tank, who later became mixed up with us. And of course, you could tell a tank man who was without his tank because he carried a revolver strapped round his lower leg. And they were running round with their tank tin hats on, trying to find out what to do and what was happening and so on. It was, that was confused. But I think perhaps that tank attack came on the afternoon of our first arrival, and that in fact the attack on ourselves by the SS or the Hitlerjugend, whichever it was, I think that may have come the second day, and that we got a surviving tank with it. Anyway, we couldn't get out at that stage, so we stayed there, and then the following night we were ordered to pull out, so we waited till darkness and pulled out and went back to point 103, and we were then picked up, taken back to Bayer, near Bayer, where we were more or less put in a field and went to sleep for best part of a day. I think we were very tired.
Roughly how many German tanks were there involved in this attack? Across the field?
Against us?
Yes.
Well, again, I don't know, you see. I could only see a little bit. But there were three or four on my side, the eastern side, across the open country. And there may have been some more behind. There were certainly along from the Tilly side, there were a whole lot more. But I don't think there were large numbers. Certainly not numbers like the, our own attack later or earlier, which was in, I've never seen a formation attack like that before, and it was, I thought it was disastrous actually, but there were not a great many of them. Ian English, of course, had a, during all this period, had a marvellous piece of heroism. He and a sergeant tried to get one of the 6-pounder anti-tank guns going. He was, of course, not a gunner himself. But in all this chaos, all the shooting and everything else, Ian and the sergeant were doing their best to manhandle the 6-pounder around to get a crack at the tank which was troubling us and that side of the village. I'm not sure if he ever succeeded in doing it. But, of course, I realised later that it wouldn't have had any effect on a German tank anyway, because they were too good. But that was Ian on that occasion.
When the German infantry attacked you through the gardens and so on, have you any idea about what strength they were in?
Oh, there were quite a lot of them. I should think that a lot of, again, it's you can only see one part of it yourself. But I suppose there were 40 or 50 of them on the part with which I was concerned. And they were coming, and they were all camouflaged up, the streak faces and so on, and scrim in the hats, air, you know, the nets. So they were all, I think about 40 or 50 of them.
Did you have any support from artillery while you were involved in this fight?
Oh, no. Not that I know of. No. No artillery.
So it would seem a natural thing to call up artillery defensive fire.
We were too far away.
We were too far away.
I think that was probably the explanation. We were out on a limb. The beachhead was miles away, and we just came out as an independent group, a column. And there was nothing. I think, as far as artillery was concerned, we might be expected to rely on our own tank guns. But certainly no artillery, no air force, nothing like that. It was a straightforward engagement, really. Small engagement between infantry with tanks.
So after this fight, you said you were left in a field back near Bayer for some time. And then what happened next?
Later on, and again, it was a day or two, we left to recover, and I think we got some reinforcements up from somewhere. And then we went off to Villers Bocage area. We went into the Bocage. And
what did the men think about that?
I don't know what the men thought about it, but it was very strange. We hadn't come across anything like that before. It was a very good defensive position for the Germans. They had pocket handkerchief fields, 50, 100 yards across and wide. Very close, very high banks, and with a lot of hedging along the top of it, or small trees running along the top. And it was a very close fighting. And we quite often stayed in a position when in fact you could have more or less thrown a grenade into the enemy positions. We were so close. But we were interested in crossfire and so on. We had our Brenz position. And so the Germans were their spandos, and we knew quite well that if anybody started going an attack, they'd just open up. That was that. So it was very, very close and very difficult. And not at all satisfactory, really. And we were there for some time, in the Bocage country. It was there, you were asking me earlier, about the Germans not using tanks at night. Well, that was the place where we had, some distance away, the Chateau d'Accordion. And I think the Chateau d'Accordion, no doubt you'd correct me on this, I think that's the place that was mentioned in the Alexandre Dumas' Three Musketeers. It was a chateau, and it had a large wall round it, which the Germans were using for tank leaguer. They had tanks at that time, which were, I think they had rubber treads, and they could move almost silently when they wanted, provided they moved slowly. And they had a very unpleasant practice, while we're in the Bocage area, of bringing these tanks up in the dark, middle of the night, to within a few yards, I was 50, 100 yards of it, with these high banks all over the place. We couldn't hear them coming, and they would suddenly open up two or three tanks at very close range, firing rapid fire both from their machine guns and from their tank guns. And the effect of that was absolutely devastating in the circumstances at such close range. It was deafening. And, of course, we never knew if the infantry were coming through with it, whether it was that sort of covering fire for them. It wasn't. It was just to annoy us and to generally harass us and upset us. That was one way they used the tanks. There was an occasion when my chap spotted an armoured car. I think there was a place called the Parc de la Mer. They spotted an armoured car, and we watched it carefully and wondered what to do about it. It was too far away for us to deal with it on our own. It wasn't easy to get messages back at that stage. These wretched radios weren't working. Telephones and radios weren't working. It was a case of sending runners and that sort of thing. And I remember we watched this for some little time, and we had a 6-pound anti-tank gun, but the sergeant in charge of it, wasn't prepared to start shooting at a tank in those circumstances, because he was too exposed in his position. And he, after we watched this for a little bit, it was suddenly somebody shouted out, "It's coming." And it was coming. The turret came round the corner and started coming down the lane right next to my position. And obviously going to get behind us at this rate. And it was coming at quite a belt. And came down, and just before it reached us, there was a loud bang, and the turret stopped. So we rushed out to deal with the occupants of the tank, the armoured car, and it turned out that it was in fact a Tiger tank. And we had in fact blown its track off with Hawkins grenades. And I'd put a few out in front, and wonderful to relate, they were very effective, they were too. They disarmed it. The Germans, obviously, occupants, thought they were going to catch fire. So they jumped out of the tank and started running along the hedge that was our front line, on our side of the hedge. And some of the chaps at the far end of the front line, our front, little front line there, suddenly saw a whole lot of Germans rushing down the hedge towards them. And being surprised, and not having known that we've a little further back had been watching the tank, they suddenly saw the Germans coming, and not being stupid, they jumped out of their slit trenches